This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
Rabble.ca.
Wings thanks Rabble Podcast Network for carrying our programs and urges listeners to contribute to their fundraiser. Please visit rabble.ca/donate today. Today on Wings.
Highlights from a panel on gender hosted by the Internet Governance Forum, held in Brazil in November 2015.
Can't just play whack-a-mole and get rid of the online content and hope that this giant kind of systemic social problem will just go away. It doesn't work that way.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world. Produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. Information communication technologies, ICTs for short, provide great new opportunities for women, and also for men who want to attack them. What can be done? A wide range of approaches came out in this Gender and the Internet panel, edited for Wings by Mindy Ran.
The Internet Governance Forum, or IGF, is multi-stakeholder and provides a platform for discussion on policy. One of the groups participating is the APC, the Association for Progressive Communications. Jan Moolman is a feminist activist who works with the Women's Rights Program of the APC and coordinates their work around violence against women and technology.
This notion of a mob, this notion of how technology is facilitating a very particular kind of masculinity that is then used, systematically planned and targeted to close voices, to close opportunities, is something that I really think that we should address. APC's working definition encompasses acts of gender-based violence that are abetted or aggravated in part or fully by the use of ICTs. Also important is the definition that the Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, CEDAW, offers, which defines violence against women as any act of gender-based violence that results in or is likely to result in physical, sexual, or psychological harm or suffering to women, including threats of such acts, coercion, or arbitrary deprivation of liberty, whether occurring in public or in private life. And we really think it's very important to foreground both these definitions when we're talking about violence against women online for two reasons. Firstly, it happens in the continuum of violence against women offline. And secondly, these universal definitions of what violence against women is and what it constitutes really have been hard-won, and we need to hold the line. And we really wanted to know, firstly, how are women actually experiencing this violence against women online? What does it look like? And how are they able to access justice, if at all? And second, what the remedies were that were available from the state and also from intermediaries. And lastly, we tried to see if there are any trends that are already coming up in terms of the development of legal remedies. So we did a lot of things. We collected case studies from 7 countries. We mapped the remedies. We undertook research into the company policies. And we also gathered 1,126 cases on a site called takebackthetech.mapit. And initially, we thought that we're going to get millions of cases, yeah, because we were aware of so many of these things happening. But many women are not reporting, either because they don't think anything will happen, or because there's a level of fear associated with experiencing this kind of violation, particularly gender trolling, including the attack that happened on the Take Back the Tech hashtag that was specifically in response to a panel at the IGF looking at countering abuses against women online. So what did we find? We found that technology-related violence against women is complex. It is not a linear issue where this is the problem, this is the solution, and this is how we're going to get there. But rather, it involves a range of different kinds of actors, all of whom need to be part of the conversation. The second thing was that what we call first-line responders, who are police, intermediaries, shelters, women's organizations, the first people that women go to, are really important in terms of the kind of justice women seek. And lastly, that there are some remedies that are available, and one of those is protection orders, which provide a very practical means for survivors to stop violence. One of the main things was that the majority of cases are perpetrated by someone known to the survivor. Often it's part of existing relationships of violence. This is also important because often when we speak about violations online, there's a great concern around anonymity. And lastly, which is quite an interesting finding, was that the internet enabled survivors of this kind of violence to claim their rights without necessarily only relying on the state. So the internet really also gives women a degree of agency in terms of being able to respond to what is happening to them.
This sense of agency or empowerment is important to many of the speakers at the IGF. One of them was Bishaka Datta. A filmmaker and activist, she is the co-founder and director of Point of View, an NGO working in gender, sexuality, and women's rights. During her slide presentation, Datta uses new words such as autocomplete, which refers to when your computer fills in a word that you have started to type, and avatar, a figure that can represent or stand in for you in a computer game or online forum. Bishaka Datta.
So what I'm going to try and do is actually shift or widen the frame a little bit and talk about two kinds of expression. One is sexual expression that is legitimate, and that is of course something that we use the internet for very, very much, and I'm not just referring to pornography. I'm referring to a much wider domain. So the first image that we see up here is actually an autocomplete from Google, and this refers to a real story based on research from India where many lesbian women who were finding it very, very difficult to actually explore their sexual orientation in the physical world because of issues of not having anonymity, etc., etc., found the internet a much safer space. And the image just shows sort of the joy of a woman when she sees that one of the autocompletes for lesbian women is women who love women. So that's one of the ways in which the internet is used very legitimately, right, for sexual exploration, sexual information, etc. The next example, and this is again a real example, is of a trans woman in India who similarly found it very difficult to explore her gender identity offline for the same reason as the women in the first slide. And the anonymity that she got online provided her the means to go to Second Life and to explore various avatars and to other apps, dating apps, etc., where she experimented with various avatars in different sort of gender identity phases and was able to locate herself on the gender continuum and place herself where she feels she really needs to belong. And just to take it to the sphere of information, this is a person who is currently going through sex reassignment surgery, and she can use information online to talk to her doctors, etc., and really know what she's going in for, right? And this, of course, is the age, as we know, of what is called the nudie or the nude selfie. And many research scholars have said sexting has now become part of sex itself in the digital age. It is no longer a gateway to sexual activity in an age where images are very close to us and where the borders between representation and reality are merging.
Sexting, or sending sexually explicit messages or images, is consensual and, like the other examples mentioned, can be seen as positive expressions of sexuality. On the other side, as we are about to hear, come concepts like revenge porn, a nude photograph or sexually explicit video or image, which is publicly shared online without consent. These are shared most frequently by an ex-partner seeking revenge or humiliation as a form of online abuse or harm. Bishaka Datta.
We now move to a slightly slippery domain. This is actually a very famous case in India. A schoolgirl and her boyfriend had consensual sex. They filmed it consensually for their own private enjoyment and pleasure. It was leaked on eBay. It created a huge scandal for the wrong reason. It didn't create the scandal that her privacy rights and his privacy rights had been violated. It created the scandal of, oh my God, these two young people having sex. A morality scandal, which is moral panic, which is absolutely the wrong thing. But you see how we go now from the domain of consensual sexual expression to a slippage and to sort of moving towards non-consensual sexual expression. And this is where we need to start thinking along issues of abuse, harassment, etc., particularly because 98% of sexual rights activists who have been surveyed by APC in numerous surveys over the years have said that they feel that the internet is an important sphere for advancing sexual rights. But at the same time, 51% of those who were surveyed said they have received abusive, threatening, violent, harassing, offensive messages. They faced intimidation, censorship, all of which have actually had a silencing effect. So we need to think of expression also in terms of not just state censorship, but actions that can silence or remove the expressive capabilities of all people online. In the Global South, I would say rape videos are to the Global South what revenge porn is to the Global North. The cases that we see are of actual rapes being filmed, like physical rapes being filmed and placed online to turn into digital pornography. This is a case which leads to a lot of complicated questions for us in India, because an activist took the images of four young people who had filmed themselves raping a young woman. She obscured the identity of the woman. She put the images of the four of them online in an attempt to get justice for the woman, and it was called Shame the Rapist campaign. Very complicated question around consent gets raised here, which is, does their consent matter? In cases like this, we tend to use the framework of actual harms and imagined harms. When somebody experiences harassment and a violation of privacy and consent, and they lose their jobs, they have to change their houses, they can no longer go out in public, they can't continue at the same school, it doesn't matter whether it's a physical harm or a psychological harm in one sense. It is an actual harm. On the other hand, when we have a situation where our government says we should ban pornography because it's causing moral degradation, we see that kind of amorphous concept as an imagined harm.
On Wings, you're listening to excerpts from the panel Gender and the Internet from the 2015 Internet Governance Forum. Here again is Wings producer Mindy Ran.
Gabrielle Guilleman is a legal officer at Article 19. Article 19 is both part of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and an NGO, both of which protect freedom of expression. Guilleman explains the difficulties they have with defining harm within the same framework as women's groups.
Now, a very important dimension of this discussion is bearing in mind what Article 19 and Free Expression protects. It's also expression which is deeply offensive. Of course, the problem most of the time is that people disagree as where the boundary lies, when grossly offensive becomes incitement to violence. And I think that's where we're going to have to discuss what that means in relation to psychological distress. For example, on Twitter, individuals being sent messages, and that person receives maybe 100,000 messages from one person, and it may be that this is something that is considered as harassment by groups working on that kind of violence, but for us, we would see it as unique acts, so one tweet, so we would not necessarily consider this as falling within the definition of harassment. One of the things we've also looked at is the issue of revenge porn, and I think here, like, we would readily agree that it's a clear violation of privacy, but that's how we would see it in the first instance, as a violation of privacy. We generally have some difficulty with using the criminal law as a response because we prefer to look at civil remedies and more generally as a means of redress, empowering women's voices to stand up to the kind of speech or harassment they receive. There's also the question of what needs to be done in terms of preventing certain things. And here I think we would really need to discuss what that means, because from our perspective, intermediaries should be immune from liability. And that also means not that content could not be removed if, for example, there was a court order, but the corollary of this is that intermediaries should not be in a position where they're forced to monitor what's going on in their network, because the problem becomes that all sorts of other groups will come into the fray to ask for their own content, their own pet issue, to be dealt with as well. And we see it already in relation to copyright, for instance. If you do this for women, why not do this for children, and so on. So for us, it's very much a slippery slope when it comes to the monitoring. That's not to say that intermediaries should do nothing about their own terms and conditions, and I think here what we would promote is more clarity around those terms and conditions, and definitely some clear processes for redress, including when material is wrongfully taken down.
Internet intermediaries can include servers who provide internet service and email, as well as Twitter, Facebook, and search engines like Google. Hiba Hussein is a public policy analyst at Google, where she focuses on partnerships with NGOs on digital security, broadband access, and other core policy issues like corporate redress.
Our whole kind of ecosystem, everything we build, all of our platforms, technology, depends on the internet staying a safe and open, vibrant place for everybody. We obviously have free expression baked into everything. It's kind of a core value, but it's not just free expression for certain types of people. It's free expression for everyone. And some chilling effects that you mentioned are real issues. If certain groups of people feel unable to participate online, that's not the kind of online platforms, online communities that we want, because it can be a really safe and important space for lots of marginalized communities. I grew up in Kansas as a Muslim American after 9/11, and I really, like, online communities were huge for me. Without live journalism, I don't know what I would have done. So making sure that those kind of communities are able to flourish, but also making sure that the whole ecosystem is a friendly, safe space for everyone. So basically our approach is, we have kind of heard repeatedly, and we agree, that you don't want corporations to make decisions about what qualifies as harassment. So we rely on our users to flag content and to tell us what's offensive, just because I don't think any of us want to live in a world where Google is making a decision on what counts as offensive content and what doesn't. That's kind of not the role of the private sector, in my opinion and the company's opinion. The stance that we have taken is we don't allow content that promotes or condones violence, or that has the primary purpose of inciting hatred on the basis of sexual orientation, gender identity, gender, race, ethnic origin, age, nationality, or veteran status. So that encompasses revenge porn. That's something that we don't allow, because unlike a lot of the Right to be Forgotten initiatives in Europe and things like that, we see that revenge porn, the primary purpose of that is shaming and violence. So we really don't have an issue with taking that down. When it comes to other speech that, you know, promotes or condones violence, it's really hard. Right now what the system is, users will flag content, and then we have teams focusing on communities around the world that are local, because you can't really have someone in Mountain View making decisions about, you know, what's offensive in India. It just doesn't really work that well. I'll be the first one to admit it's not a perfect system, just because of issues of scale. You know, we have hundreds and thousands of things flagged every day, and so you have people, you know, frantically trying to figure out what is actually harmful speech is difficult, but it's something that we're putting more and more resources into every single day.
One of the ways Google has tried to get creative in their everyday search for solutions is to develop concepts like counter speech, which is just what it sounds like, using positive messages, often in large quantities, to counter harmful ones. Hiba Hussein.
The area where we have the biggest issues right now is YouTube, the YouTube comment space. It's a space that is just horrible right now. You know, users can choose to not have comments or can choose to take comments down. But again, questions of scale come out. You can have 100 hateful comments in the span of 2 minutes and you have to like frantically try to delete them all or block a user. So our strategy is really developing more and more tools to really empower users to quickly take action to get redress in cases of hateful, violent speech. We don't really see broad legal regulation as kind of the answer to this. And there was actually a really good EFF blog post where they really highlighted the ways in which overbroad legal kind of just blanket solutions can just make it harder for anybody to use the internet for anything and make it easier for people who already are powerful in society to just control this other platform, because that's kind of how regulation tends to work. So we've been working with a lot of different groups promoting counter speech as a solution to a lot of this speech, really working with groups like the National Network to End Domestic Violence on some of their kind of counter speech and privacy and security initiatives, because that is also, of course, the other side of this, making sure that people have the option to be anonymous if they need to kind of make sure that they're able to speak online without having their real lives threatened. So you can kind of shut it down online, but the key root of that violence and hatred really does remain. So we've been thinking a lot about how to partner with traditional kind of women's rights organizations who have the history of working in these communities, who know what violence looks like online and offline, just because you can't really separate those two. Can't just play whack-a-mole and get rid of the online content and hope that this giant kind of systemic social problem will just go away. It doesn't work that way. So we think that people need to have the right to be anonymous online for a variety of reasons, you know, activists, dissidents, journalists, and kind of repressive regimes. There are a lot of people who say, you know, well, if you had a real name policy, people wouldn't make hateful comments. But I think the flip side is also true for us in the sense that you can't really have people speaking out, sharing their stories, reporting on violence that they've experienced if they have to have their real name attached to it, because there are a lot of implications. I think when we talk about free speech, that a lot of these experiences make it impossible for women to participate fully and robustly online. So there is kind of a chilling effect. So I think that some of the other things that I'd love to explore with all of you is the role of counter speech. You know, how can we use positive speech and some of the positive communities that a lot of my panelists have mentioned to counter the horrible cesspool of violent kind of hateful content. It's something that we have worked a lot in when it comes to like violent extremism. So kind of working with Muslim American communities to really get another narrative out and to empower another kind of voice. But it's obviously more complicated and difficult in this space to translate that same strategy. So we've been thinking about how to promote more empowering speech in a way that helps communities grow and in a way that also translates to offline power as well, because that is obviously a crucial part of all of this. So.
While many shun legal redress, some embrace it. One of the new laws was recently passed in New Zealand. Ellen Strickland is the Community Program Director for Internet NZ and community engagement and collaboration activities, including collaboration with the government.
We have a harmful digital communications bill, which is a national piece of legislation, which does provide for criminal offence in the case of harm caused online. And that came through this July, but it's been a process going back to 2013. And as Internet NZ, our policy team has been a part of the creation. We've done community consultations and worked with the government and parties that were involved in drafting it. Now, the bill itself sort of politically came about youth online, really, cyberbullying. There was real concern about the harm that was being caused to young people, but that over the course of discussion it was broadened and it really came into focus and got quite a lot of political support in 2013. Around a very specific case, which is quite famous in New Zealand, called the Roastbusters case. And the Roastbusters were a group of young men who had a page on Facebook, which they used to post filmed sexual abuse of young women who were drunk at parties. And they received a warning, basically, from the police, and who said that there was nothing they could do, and boys being boys. And so that caused a lot of discussion, the online aspect of it and the harm, the ongoing harm that was caused by this, but then also what was filmed, you know, in itself should be something that should be prosecuted. And that we believe that best legislation should be crafted to reflect the internet world and apply on and offline. Now, the Harmful Digital Communications Bill does provide for prosecution and sort of, I think it's 2 years in prison and $50,000 for harm caused, but that there's a process. So there's an approved agency, and really the focus is on, and I'll actually read you, the purpose of the bill reflects some of the things that we talked about. So it's to deter, prevent, and mitigate harm caused to individuals by digital communications. But that its second purpose is to provide victims of harmful digital communications with a quick, efficient means of redress. So that focus on supporting people who've been harmed and helping them is why there is an agency model. It says to use, to advise, to negotiate, to mediate, to persuade, to resolve complaints. So while the bill was passed in July, we're actually now in the process of figuring out who this approved agency will be. So while we have the law, we don't have the agency yet. So for us, I mean, there's a lot of just wait and see what happens. I mean, we're aware that we're at the front edge of legislation of this kind, and it's something, so just in the last 2 days, you know, unfortunately, we've had what's being called Roastbusters 2, and that there's been another Facebook page of, again, you know, young men, this is in high school, who are posting, it's a competition to post images of sexually abusing women. And the police again have just issued a warning, and so it's created a lot of discussion in the media, saying, okay, we've got this bill now, you know, and part of it is about creating awareness and definitions, and that the same practice is happening. Mm-hmm. So I think that just opens up quite an interesting discussion that, you know, you can. So legislation, is it, you know, going too far? Should we be working at other things? But that even when you have it, you know, if the practice that you have with law enforcement and the way that they view these situations, it comes down to that, you know, and I certainly think that there is some views of online as not being serious, and it's funny, which is a real concern.
Our thanks to the Women's Rights Program of the Association for Progressive Communications for permission to make this program. This program featured Jan Moolman, Bishaka Datta, Gabrielle Guilleman, Hiba Hussein, and Ellen Strickland. This has been Mindy Ran in Amsterdam.
In May of 2016, Wings will have been in distribution for 30 years. We're extremely grateful to all the community radio stations around the world that have carried our programs, and to audiences for listening. Thanks also to the Rabble Podcast Network, to the community radio distribution systems of Australia, Canada, and the United States, to Suzette Cullen, who has been a rock and fellow traveler since 1996, and to Genevieve Vaughn, who's been supportive of women's radio since 1985. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden, Wings co-founder and series producer. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.